Thank you very much, Andrew. Thank you very much, Andrew, for that introduction, and thank you to the Royal Historical Society of Victoria for inviting me to reflect on Robert Menzies at the 50th anniversary of his departure from the Federal Parliament. It's an interesting date from my point of view, and I suppose this just feeds into Andrew's introduction, but 50 years ago last week, I was sitting listening to Robert Menzies attend the Kooyong electorate committee and tell the committee why he was resigning from Parliament. And that was, I think, the closest I ever got to Robert Menzies. My father once pointed him out walking down Collins Street, but that meeting was the first time that I'd really been in close proximity to the man himself. And when I left it, I was a young man at the time, I thought, you know, this is a historic moment that I've just been a part of, so I'll write it down, what happened. And I did, in fact, create a record of that meeting. And it's interesting now, turning up my old typescript 50 years later, to refresh my memory about who was there and what Menzies said. He arrived in what was then a black Commonwealth car, and he was very generous to his electors and, of course, to his party. He'd been the representative for Kooyong since 1934. And as a young university student, fascinated by political ideas, I thought, well, what is he going to tell us about and give emphasis to? And so when I consulted my notes, I found that he, first of all, talked a lot about the electorate and how people had basically left him alone to get on with the job of being Prime Minister. But in a few sentences, he then spoke about his government, and he opened up with the statement that it was a matter of tremendous pride to him that his government had observed the highest standards of public life, that it was a government of integrity, and it was a government of high quality appointments and strong administration. And that was very interesting. He said laws can be changed, but administration can have a terrible effect on a country if it's bad, and it's not always easy to correct that effect. So Menzies is a man who really has interested me throughout my political life, not only because he founded the Liberal Party, or I think many Liberals would say it was one of the founders of the Liberal Party, but certainly the man without whom it would not have come into existence. But he was a man whose ideas seemed to have an enormous impact on national life. And within the Liberal Party, there were always debates about, well, is that in line with Menzies' liberalism or isn't? And people still debate Menzies' liberalism. And the question today is it relevant to us now? Or is there a new liberalism? Or have we moved beyond liberalism? Or some question of that kind. So I thought tonight I'd reflect a little bit on Menzies' liberalism, what he thought. But I'd start off with a statement about Menzies the man. And Menzies, of course, was Prime Minister of Australia for over 18 years in total, in two tranches, as we say. He was a man of unquestioned integrity, high intelligence, I believe without racial or religious prejudice of any kind, a believer in civilised political debate. He detested personal abuse as a form of argument, and he had a deep and patriotic love of his country. Now, of course, as Andrew says, despite these qualities, and if one agrees with them, nevertheless, Menzies aroused passions as few politicians have done amongst both his friends and his foes. And you can get as many critiques of Menzies from his friends as from his foes. And I think these passions had a great deal to do with the kind of man that Menzies was and the ideas that he espoused and stood for. Sometimes his friends were awed, frustrated, annoyed, perhaps even at times jealous of Menzies' intellectual dominance and independence. People like to influence other people. While Menzies' political foes, I've come to the conclusion, feared his skills and his ideas, which were counter to theirs, and his relentless purpose in trying to get those ideas accepted and made governing ideas for the country. And they set out to damage his reputation and, of course, if possible, as it's not only in this case in politics, to destroy their opponent. I think a focus on Menzies' ideas reveals to us a rather different man to the caricature of Menzies that people think of if you ask, well, what do you think about Robert Menzies? Because so much of what we know in the popular ethos about Menzies derives from memories of the political arguments of the day and the press and caricatures. They follow the self-interested lines of friends and foes. And it's not easy, I think, and I've found this personally, to see through all this to the kind of man that I think Menzies was. And this talk provides me with an opportunity, really, to try to cut through some of the chaff around Menzies and to look at what I think brings us closer to the core of the man. Menzies is often portrayed as a conservative manipulator of power, but and ideas are generally left out of the equation. In fact, when I have been doing research on Menzies, I've been quite astonished at how some in-depth studies of Menzies, and the one that I think of first and admire greatly is Alan Martin's biography of Robert Menzies. But you could read right through that book and have very little understanding of what Menzies' real motivations were, or what his ideas were, or what he was trying to do. And so by focusing on Menzies' ideas, I think we get much closer to the real man. And it might surprise you if I say that I believe that Menzies was a highly idealistic and values-driven politician. He was generally, genuinely principled. I don't mean generally, I mean genuinely principled man in politics. And that's why he was Prime Minister for 18 years and could get up to before his electorate committee on his retirement and say that he had always run a government of integrity. Now, I want to just have a closer look at this man. And Menzies certainly, and not unlike John Howard, believed that ideas were the heart of politics. That in the end, political debates and political contests and governments and oppositions were all about ideas. And he believed that the art of politics is to convey ideas to others if possible, to persuade a majority to agree, to create or encourage a public opinion so soundly based that it endures and is not blown aside by chance winds, to persuade people to have long-range views. And of course, when you read this and think, well, if we've got someone here who was serious about this, it starts to mark Menzies out as an unusual person. It's not that all politicians don't have ideas. I think all politicians do have a credo of one kind or another. But Menzies set about developing a very elaborate understanding of the world and human nature and the nature of politics and what would create a good society, and then spent his 40 years in politics trying to sell that to the country. And it's a difficult challenge to think, well, who else fits this characteristic? Menzies self-consciously put forward ideas, and I think as a political scientist I would say that, of course, there were practical reasons why he did this and why people these days urge our political leaders to start making the case in an articulate and coherent way that our philosophy enables. And that is because ideas are the main weapon in politics for addressing politics and problems, guiding the way to sound policies, if the ideas are sound, keeping a political party behind you, unified. It's much easier if everyone is committed to a set of ideas that the leader knows how to articulate. And ideas, to be effective, have to be represented by an organisation. And one of the very interesting things about Menzies, which I think is overlooked, is that Menzies was a continual former of groups and organisations to promote his ideas. The Liberal Party is one of them, and probably his greatest architectural achievement, if you like, because it's still around. But before the Liberal Party, Menzies was very fruitful in establishing organisations to make an impact on the problems and what he believed were the false and misguided ideas that were letting Australia down. Now, it might be helpful at this point to just remind us all of Menzies' CV. This is the young Menzies. Around about 1913. So he was just about 20 years old then, not quite. His parents were James and Kate. He was the fourth of five children. He was educated, having won top the state scholarship exam at Grenville College in Ballarat, and then met a friend on the train who was enrolling at Wesley, went off to Wesley where he was snared by Adamson as the principal of Wesley, and later went on to the University of Melbourne where he had a distinguished student leadership career as the editor of the Melbourne University magazine and was president of the Student Representative Council, and an outstanding law degree, was admitted to the bar as a junior associate of Owens Dixon, who later became Chief Justice. He married Patty May Leckie in 1920 after he'd made a bit of money before the High Court, and he has three children, Kenneth, Ian and Heather. His parliamentary career started off in Victoria. He's one of the few state politicians who made it into the federal parliament, and he started talking about his liberalism at the state level. He came in as minister without portfolio, and just to show how principled he was, he shortly resigned from the ministry because he didn't agree with the terms on which the government was striking an agreement with the Progressive Country Party of the time. And indeed, for two decades, the Country Party was his nemesis, and it represented something he didn't like about politics, and he said so often. And then in 1934, he went to the House of Representatives in Canberra as a member for Kooyong. He was a minister in the government of Joseph Lyons, became Prime Minister when Lyons died in 1939, and was Prime Minister for 2 years, resigned in one of the most extraordinary episodes in Australian political history in 1941, and after a short period out of the position of Leader of the Opposition, came back and was Leader of the Opposition from 43 to 49, and then, of course, his great term as Prime Minister from 1949 through to 1966. He belonged to three major political parties, the Nationalist Party, the United Australia Party, and then, of course, the Liberal Party. How do we know what Menzies thought? What was Menzies' liberalism all about? Well, it's worth just reminding ourselves that he did put pen to paper. He, of course, gave many major political speeches, wrote many newspaper articles, but did write and publish a number of books. But the one that has attracted most attention and that I was responsible for editing the first republication of since 1943 was The Forgotten People. And in The Forgotten People, he called The Forgotten People a summarised political philosophy. In other words, he believed he had a political philosophy, and he set out in the middle of the Second World War to tell people what it was in simple and clear terms. And then when he wrote a collection, there's a collection of his speeches, Speeches of Time, and then when he retired, he wrote several other books in which he spelt out further some aspects of his ideas. The text that I want to take as a sort of guiding text for my remarks tonight is this one. And it's something that Menzies said when he led the formation of the Liberal Party in October 1944 at a conference in Canberra. He said, "What we must look for, and it is a matter of desperate importance to our country, is a true revival of liberal thought, which will work for social justice and security, for national power and national progress, and for the full development of the individual citizen, though not through the dull and deadening process of socialism." And in a way, that sums it up, but the most interesting aspect of that statement to me is the first sentence part of it. It's a matter of desperate importance to our country that there be a revival of liberal thought. Menzies had come to the view that Australia was a badly damaged country. By the time he became Prime Minister in 1939, and he believed that Australia's future was at risk in 1944. And he argued that if it was not possible to revive liberal thinking in the country as a whole, then the future of Australia was very bleak. And I'm going to expand on all of this and focus the story a bit around why he thought that. Now, I want to outline before I do that just what some of the key core ideas of Menzies' liberalism was, so you can get a sense of the shape of Menzies' thinking. And of course, there's nothing particularly original about that, that somebody's ideas are influenced by the culture from which they draw their key concepts and terms. They're influenced particularly in their emphasis by the family within which they're brought up. They're influenced by the current political debate of the day, and they're influenced by one's experience of life and, of course, in Menzies' case, politics. And I won't dwell on this, but, of course, Menzies' liberalism is a development of the liberalism of the 19th century in Australia, what is commonly called colonial liberalism. I put up four key figures there, but, of course, there could be 50 figures there. Wentworth, he's a Whig, of course, and not a Liberal, but the gift of the Whigs to the liberalism was the principles of the Glorious Revolution of 1688, for those who know about it, and the 1689 Bill of Rights, the supremacy of Parliament, and the civil liberties that went with that, that were guaranteed in the Bill of Rights. And then, of course, the great liberals, some of the great liberals of the 19th century, Parkes, who's an English immigrant, and Griffith, born in Wales. And I put Graham Berry up there as well because he was a Victorian. who founded the first Liberal Party in Victoria, the Liberal Party for which Deakin stood when he first stood for Parliament. And the content of colonial liberalism is very recognisable from Wentworth's point of view: trial by jury, representative assembly, no taxation without representation, the rule of law, and then the liberty of the individual was absolutely central to it, freedom of religion, universal education, private property, free trade. All of those went right back to the 1830s. Governor Burke advocated all of those, the man who founded Melbourne. And then later on, free trade, free selection, legal unionism, and legal protection for workers from harm through factory acts. It's just a highly selective listing. More relevantly, of course, is what was Menzies' relationship to the great pre-World War I liberals, Alfred Deakin and George Read. And I've come to the conclusion that Menzies' liberalism was quite different in many respects to the liberalism of Deakin, and less so, but still different from the liberalism of Read. Because Read, of course, was the leader of the free trade cause, and from 1949 till 1966, right through the Menzies' second term, Australia was protectionist. So what did Menzies think about free trade? And what would he have thought about the reforms of the 1980s and the Howard government? I'll come to it. Alfred Deakin was, I think, very different from Menzies in that he had a highly idealistic view about what democratic government could achieve through regulation. Menzies was much less willing to regulate society than Deakin. He thought, in fact, that his major political tasks in many ways were trying to remedy the policy problems and national problems caused by Deakin's decisions. Of course, Deakin was associated with protection, white Australia, and the compulsory arbitration system, all of which Menzies had very grave doubts about. The only purpose of this slide is to make the point that Deakin's, when we talk about Menzies' liberalism, it is very wide-ranging. It's quite an extraordinary intellectual construction. And he sought to make every element of it consistent with every other element of it. And so it covered Australia's political institutions, how Parliament should work, the importance of parliamentary government as against people with power outside the Parliament, the independence of the judiciary, that was sort of from the 19th century. The importance of the party system was fundamental to Menzies' whole approach. The need for national policy to be based on the public interest and not selfish interest, and I will say something a bit more about that. The importance of individual freedom was a fundamental idea in Menzies' liberalism, which was quite a contrast to Deakin, who never really talked a lot about that until he'd ceased to be Prime Minister. The role of civic values, of reasoned argument rather than prejudice, was absolutely fundamental to Menzies' political style. In fact, he saw himself as confronting what he thought were the hatreds that were dividing Australian society. And they were sectarian hatreds that had come out of the 19th century but been exacerbated by the conscription debates in the First World War. They were class hatreds being stirred up by those who wanted to get rid of the liberal economy and replace it with an administered socialist economy. And they were racial hatreds that were kind of implicit in white Australia, though it was a more complex phenomenon than many think. But came to the fore in the Second World War when we were fighting the Japanese. And Menzies was horrified by the impact of that war on the culture. And, of course, Australia's place in the world. Now, the core idea, if I could just emphasise it, in Menzies' thinking was the supreme importance of the individual person. That Menzies did not like the big collectivities of race and ethnicity and nationality and class, because he saw they were associated with prejudices and hatreds, and they could lead to the individual being crushed and the rights of the individual ignored. And Menzies' concept of the good society was to find a legal and political and policy framework which would provide encouragement and recognition to the individual. And this is a statement, in fact, that he made in 1944. I see the individual and his encouragement and recognition as the prime motive force for the building of a better world. Socialism means high costs, inefficiency, the constant intrusion of political considerations, the damping down of enterprise, the overlordship of routine. None of these elements can produce progress, and without progress, security will turn out to be a delusion. And that is really the core idea that Menzies brought to his definition of liberalism. And he thought that within a framework of just laws, people who could set their own missions in life and set out to realise their own ambitions would work together to create a good society. And one of the ideas that he took from 19th century liberalism and that was a constant theme was the need for social harmony. The aim of government must be a harmonious society, and the aim of politics must be to encourage social harmony and not to encourage social division. And he thought Australia was a deeply divided society in 1939. The idea that individuals produce progress, he then elaborated into the economic area, that the prime duty of government was to encourage enterprise, to provide a climate favourable to growth. And then he put in again this fundamental idea, it is the individual whose energies produce progress and all social benefits derive from his efforts. And being a good Scot, child of the Scottish Enlightenment, Menzies asked, well, how do you empower the individual? And of course, his core policy commitment, if you like, apart from protecting Australia, was education. And I think this is a remarkable statement. It was in The Forgotten People in 1942 when it was first given as a radio talk. And it's such a strong statement. It's not a piece of political rhetoric. It's throwing down the gauntlet. And it was relevant right through his time in office, and it is relevant right up to today. In the new world, when people were talking about reconstruction after the war, we must seek to develop all the intelligence and strength and character in every child. Each one of them must have his chance. When the war is won, look at this, for every 100 boys and girls who now pass into higher schools and universities, there must be 1,000. Lack of money must be no impediment to bright minds. Think Hicks. Wasn't a Menzies policy. To develop every human being to his fullest capacity for thought, for action, for sacrifice and endurance is our major task. And no prejudice, stupidity, selfishness or vested interest must stand in the way. Higher education for women must come to be regarded as normal. Now, that was quite a strong statement in 1942 in the middle of the war. And, of course, he did fulfil that. After 1949, he set out to give effect to that. I thought I'd put this in 1942 so that the Holocaust did not become evident at this time, though he himself in government had brought many thousands of Jewish refugees from Germany, but he'd visited Germany, and the thing he was horrified about was the level of censorship and government propaganda. Without free speech, he took the John Stuart Mill position. Without free speech, error might never be discovered and truth would be suppressed. Hence, if truth is to emerge and in the long run be triumphant, the process of free debate, the untrammelled clash of opinion, must go on. And of course, he never tried to interfere with the media. He did write a very thoughtful essay on censorship in time of war. And then I thought I'd just show you this statement as well, which I think is again an utterly remarkable statement. In 1942, when the Japanese were bombing Australia, and he complained about the official advertising against the Japanese, which said, as he says there, apropos, we always did despise them anyhow. And Menzies said to the Australian public over the radio, now if I may take that last observation first, it does seem to me fantastically foolish and dangerous. It is, in my opinion, poor policy to try to persuade people to despise the Japanese. If this war, with all its tragedy, breeds into us a deep-seated and enduring spirit of hatred, then the peace, when it comes, will be merely the prelude to the disaster, and not an end to it. And that was a very consistent line that Menzies took on the matter of race and prejudice. Now, I'm going to focus on the early years of Menzies. I think after 1949, with the exception of protection, which I want to say a bit about, his most whole substance of his philosophy was in place, I think by 1939 when he first became Prime Minister. And I just want to look at some of the causes of that. And the ones I want to look at are the family. I want to look at his political experience when he first entered politics. And I want to look at the ideas that were being promoted against liberalism. And as you'll see as we go through this, Menzies' solution was to set up an organisation to promote his ideas. First of all, one of the things about Menzies... Excuse me, that's my microphone. Okay. Podcast will be interrupted. And I think I've traced three influences to the family that he grew up in, his family of origin. A rejection of emotionalism and commitment to a very cool, rational mode of argument. The sense that politics was a public service. Wasn't, you're not there for a job, you're not there to earn an income, you're not there to exercise power for its own sake, it is a public service. And thirdly, belief in the importance of principle. Now, I couldn't find, in the time I had to prepare for this lecture, early photos of Menzies and his parents, but this is a photo of Menzies with his two parents, James and Kate, when they came up to see him, probably, I think, when he was just about Prime Minister in 1939. Now, Menzies had an odd relationship with his father, and I'm not being deeply psychological when I say that. He's written about it. And what he had to say is extremely interesting. His father was a politician. He spoke, he was the member for Lowen in the Victorian Legislative Assembly. He spoke on the platform very emotionally. And Menzies used to say he would squirm in his seat every time he had to listen to his father talk. And he decided that he would not take that style. He would be a different style. He emphasised logic and rationality. But when he reflected in Afternoon Light on all of this, you can see him trying to strike the balance. My father's emotional character derived from a deep-seated faith and belief. He had not been through the disciplined experiences of the law, like me, and so paradoxically was nearer to the surface in the expression of things that were deepest in his heart. I wish today there were more like him. So that expiates that ghost from the past. And then he says, it is one thing to be the coldly reasoning product of the schools, that's him, The objectivity thus produced, and then he says, he defends it, is needed badly in a world in which there is so much passion and prejudice, malice, hatred, and all uncharitableness. But there is a great place in life for beliefs so strongly held that they must find utterance and sway the hearts of men. And of course, that was the main criticism that was always made of Menzies before 91 in 1949, probably before the bank nationalisation in 1947, that he couldn't sway people. He couldn't appeal to people. That's what his colleagues told him, and it was one of the explanations he gave for his resignation as Prime Minister in 1941. The second impact that the family had on him was the idea that politics was a public service. And this isn't, again, just rhetoric. The Menzies were known in Japaret as absolutely the leaders of local community works and services. My parents, he writes, were a remarkable pair of people with great talents, high moral purpose, which he had himself, and an intense and self-sacrificing desire to see their children make some unselfish but competent, and here you can, the modesty just shines through, contribution to life. My father was a great one for getting things done in this. He was completely unselfish, for all his greatest crusades were for others. And of course, that idea translated, when you got into politics, into the idea that the purpose of politics was not private interest, but public interest. And then there's the question of the politics of principle. But Menzies came from a highly idealistic family. Both his father and his father-in-law had been members of parliament. His father-in-law particularly, Dame Patty's father, was a highly idealistic man. And the Menzies family, and I'm quite sure Bob himself, when you look at what happened, were terribly critical of the Nationalist Party, the party that had been formed and was the dominant party on his side, their side of politics in the 20s, had been formed when the party of Deakin came together with the fragment that Hughes rescued out of the Labor Party when it expelled him in 1916-17 and formed the Nationalist Party. Hughes was, from the Menzies' point of view, a very bad leader of that party because Hughes was actually anti-capitalist and believed in government ownership of enterprises and not a strong supporter of private enterprise at all. And although there were elements of liberalism in Hughes's early thinking, he was quite authoritarian in his style and utterly disorganised as a leader. But Bruce also was a problem for Menzies and his family. Bruce was a young businessman. He was only about 35 when he became Prime Minister. And I think, again, this is a fascinating statement by Menzies in Afternoon Light when he writes about Bruce. He was, of all the notable men I have been associated with, the most down-to-earth and practical and the least concerned with either theory or rhetoric. Now, that sounds in Australia like a compliment, you know, pragmatist, down-to-earth. To Menzies, if you read it knowing Menzies, I don't think it is a compliment. It's saying he can't persuade, he doesn't have the language, and he doesn't act according to principle. And certainly Bruce was notable for his constant changes of views, particularly on industrial relations. He believed in centralisation, Menzies opposed that and campaigned against it, and then in extreme devolution. And so you see on the your far right there, J.W. Leckie, Menzies' father-in-law, who was one of a group who set up a body called the Australian Liberal Party in 1927. Nationalism posed a crisis for Australian liberalism, and certainly the Menzies family, and I don't doubt Menzies himself, felt it very deeply. But he decided to join the Nationalists, because they formed the government at the state and the federal level. But he set up a party within a party, a first example of Menzies organising to promote his ideas, the Young Nationalist. He did it with Kent Hughes, and the first president was Nettlefold. But the Young Nationalist was essentially a vehicle for the promotion of Menzies' view of liberalism. And the problem that had arisen from the kind of unprincipled government, as Menzies saw it, that the Nationalists provided, was that the state absolutely exploded. Australia, spending as a percentage of GDP, was probably the highest in the Western world at the time, well above Britain, certainly far above the United States and Canada. Total public debt had reached 127, 128% of GDP, sort of Greece proportions, and was impossible to borrow further in London. Keynes advised his London investors not to buy Australian bonds. The Western world's most regulated labour market existed in Australia, and of course Australia was second only to the United States in its levels of protection of domestic industry, a policy which destroyed the international competitiveness of Australian manufacturing industry. And of course, when the Depression struck, Australia had one of the highest unemployment rates in the world. And of course, government business enterprises in Australia were described by Eggleston, and I noticed Jeff Blaney has endorsed this, but probably the largest in the world outside the Soviet Union, particularly in Victoria. There's just a huge emphasis on government enterprise. And in fact, the Australian Liberal Party of Leckie's was set up because the Nationalist government had just nationalised the urban bus routes. Now, I won't go in detail into Menzies' particular ideas at the time, but this is what he concluded. I believe that a large majority of the public today is perfectly ready to give its adherence to a party which will display political principle and political courage. We've suffered far too much from people of no political convictions beyond a more or less genteel adherence to our side of politics. That kind of adherence is worthless. We must have people who believe things and who are prepared to go out and struggle to make their beliefs universal. This is just underscores, really, I think, the fact that Menzies was a person of ideas. And of course, the person who symbolised the ideas he really hated because they were anti-liberal ideas was J.T. Lang. In fact, he was expelled by the Labor Party itself, in the whole New South Wales branch of the Labor Party, in 1931. But nothing indicates more clearly why Menzies felt the liberal case had to be made. And this is not easy to find, this one. I had to go to the press for this one because it's not in Lang's biography and it's not commonly in the history of the period. At the 1931 ALP Easter Conference, there was a motion that New South Wales become a socialised state within 3 years. And that government should be not by parliament or by law, but by regulation. And indeed, Lang's brother-in-law told the conference that a people's government must take control, and the chairman of the New South Wales ALP Socialisation Committee told the conference capitalism has failed and socialism must have its trial. Parliaments are stinking in the nostrils of the electors. And the reason I show that is because it's important to realise just how extreme the political debate became during the Depression and why Menzies felt there was a desperate need to revive liberal thought. And so what he did was to set up a group in Melbourne of quite distinguished former citizens. Staniforth Ricketson, a stockbroker, Kingsley Henderson, architect and later director of the Argus, Ambrose Pratt, who was a writer and a very eccentric sort of man, but in the end it was Ambrose Pratt who wrote Joe Lyon's resignation from the Labor Party. And it was Menzies and this group that helped to persuade, particularly Menzies, to persuade Latham to resign and Lyons to come over, much against, in many ways, his better judgment, to lead the United Australia Party. And so Menzies played a critical role in history at the time that is often overlooked. And of course, after the Lyons government became Prime Minister and made this comment about Australian democracy. There's been no doubt this democracy has been sick. If and when it can be cured, there's great work to do, but it will never be cured unless we see the past clearly and recognise frankly that we cannot ignore politics and treat democracy as a mere matter of loaves and fishes, by which he meant that policy was made by special interests and not according to principle and not according to some political philosophy. Now, I propose to finish here because really this is the substance of where Menzies gets to. National unity is crucial for him. The Labor Party won't become a national government. He sets up the Advisory War Council that includes Curtin. When Curtin becomes Prime Minister, he includes Menzies. So Australia manages a degree of unity despite the difficulties of the time and the divisions within the Labor Party. Curtin's great achievement was to try to unify the Labor Party. And Menzies then, out of office again, writes The Forgotten People. And essentially that becomes the blueprint for his later time in government and remains in many ways the key document that his side of politics looks back to. And its core ideas are those that I've outlined before. So I think it's an appropriate thing to finish at The Forgotten People and say Menzies' liberalism is established and we can discuss in conversation afterwards or questions if you want to ask questions about the later period. Thank you.